It's the NPR News Update for Tuesday, April 21. I'm Phil Picardi with the Minnesota News Podcast. Coming up, more on the arrests of Twin Cities men in a terror probe. What's behind the avian flu outbreak? We have a plan for big tax cuts. A Twin Cities police department looks for more space. Robots do the jobs of small-town workers. A new target line touches a nerve. And the Hockey Wild are riding high against the thuggish St. Louis Blues. First, federal authorities have charged six young Minnesota men with trying to join the terrorist group ISIS in Syria. The weekend arrests represent the biggest counterterrorism sweep in the Twin Cities since the FBI last year began investigating local connections to the brutal ISIS extremists in the Middle East. Laura Ewan has more.
Prosecutors say the six men, all between ages 19 and 21, were dogged and unwavering in their mission. U.S. Attorney Andrew Luger told reporters the men were determined to travel by bus or car from coast to coast to get onto airplanes that would eventually take them to the battlefields of ISIS. Even after their own failed attempts, Luger says they never stopped plotting a way to get to Syria.
They were not confused young men. They were not easily influenced. These are focused men who are intent on joining a terrorist organization by any means possible.
The six, Zakaria Abdurrahman, Haned Musa, Guled Omar, Abdurrahman Daoud, and Anand Farah and his brother Mohammed Farah, were arrested Sunday in Minneapolis and San Diego. The FBI says the two men who were arrested in California had taken a road trip on Friday to get fake passports. The two were planning to cross into Mexico and fly out to the Middle East before federal agents rounded them up. The six men were friends with three other young Twin Cities men who have already been charged with joining or trying to join ISIS. And all six were from Minnesota's Somali community, where one question remains top of mind. Again, Andy Luger.
People often ask, who is doing the terror recruiting in Minnesota? And when will we catch the person responsible? But it is not that simple. In today's case, the answer is that this group of friends is recruiting each other. They are engaged in what we describe as peer-to-peer recruiting, friend-to-friend, brother-to-brother.
But Luger says they got some help from a friend. 21-year-old Abdi Noor of Minneapolis was one who got away. He made it to Syria, and authorities say he's now acting as a recruiter for ISIS, offering ideas and inspiration to his buddies in Minnesota. Luger says the case of Abdi Noor shows how vulnerable young people are to the contagion of radical ideas.
What this case shows is that the person radicalizing your son, your brother, your friend, may not be a stranger. It may be their best friend right here in town.
But it was a friend who helped the FBI crack the case, an unnamed young man who was scheming for months to travel to Syria and had previously denied any involvement to the FBI, eventually had a change of conscience, according to the FBI. The source allowed his conversations with the other men to be recorded. Authorities say those calls gave an inside glimpse into the depth of the men's commitment to join ISIS. According to the complaint in one conversation, a defendant, Mohammed Farah, made clear his desire to abandon his American identity. Even if I get caught, he said, I'm through with America. Burn my ID. Abdurrashid Daoud is the younger brother of another defendant, Abdurrahman Daoud. The younger Daoud showed up to support his brother at the first court appearance for four of the men in St. Paul today. Standing outside of the courthouse, Daoud says he's angered about the role of the informant.
And he lied to my brothers and them. He basically set them up for a failure. I'm very, very mad at Allah, especially one of our brothers, a Somali guy, that's working with the feds for what reason. I don't understand, bro. That's wrong of him doing that, man. See, they could be looking at a lot of years because of what he did right now.
There's no evidence suggesting the men were planning attacks within the U.S. FBI Special Agent in Charge Rick Thornton says the case shows just how difficult it will be to dismantle the recruiting network in Minnesota. At the same time, he thanked Somali American community members who he said helped stop the six men from leaving.
These courageous men and women decided to do something to prevent more Minnesotans from traveling and dying in support of a terrorist organization which is evil to its core.
But Luger, the U.S. attorney, says this kind of prevention is a shared responsibility.
We have a terror recruiting problem in Minnesota. The problem will not go away unless we address it head on. It's not a Somali problem. It's not an immigrant problem.
It is our problem, he said, a Minnesota problem. With reporting from Mukhtar Ibrahim, I'm Laura Ewan, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
The deadly flu virus that has wiped out nearly 5% of Minnesota's turkey industry is a part of a global disease outbreak. The avian flu started in Asia and has spread to poultry farms in the Netherlands, Great Britain, and Germany, and now has arrived in North America. These new avian viruses have traveled around the globe quickly, surprising and alarming scientists. Investigators in Minnesota are trying to unravel the mystery of how these deadly bugs have infected so many turkey farms in such a short period of time. Lorna Benson reports.
The rapid spread of avian influenza to dozens of Minnesota turkey farms bewilders Dr. Carol Cardona, a University of Minnesota avian flu expert.
It's been really troubling to understand how in the world this can possibly be happening.
A popular theory among many scientists suggests that wild waterfowl are depositing the virus across the landscape in their feces as they migrate north. Cardona agrees that's likely, since the virus has been detected in numerous wild ducks and geese. These birds can be infected with flu and not appear sick. But Cardona says it's hard to fathom that waterfowl alone could explain such an unprecedented flu outbreak. She suspects another bird species is helping to spread the virus.
This is so unusual that we can't help but think something different must be going on.
In addition to wild ducks and geese, these new viruses have also been detected in live coots and cranes. But Cardona says there are thousands of other bird species that haven't even been tested for the virus yet. Another theory suggests the viruses may have changed in a way that makes it easier for wild birds to catch and carry these poultry flu strains. Avian flu researcher Ron Fouché is a professor of molecular virology at Erasmus University Medical Center in Rotterdam in the Netherlands. He co-authored an article for Science magazine earlier this year that supports that view.
It's possible that upon genetic mixing with wild bird viruses, these viruses have become more capable of spreading through wild birds, but this is something that's still under investigation.
While the outbreaks have occurred in many countries, Minnesota stands out. The more than two dozen cases of flu reported here are so geographically spread out, they're seemingly unrelated. Biosecurity mistakes are thought to be a likely method of disease introduction at many of the turkey farms. But bad circumstances may be a factor, too. State and federal investigators are looking at the possibility that strong spring winds could have made the flu problem worse, at least in some locations. Avian flu isn't typically spread across great distances by wind, but some researchers say it's possible the virus could have been blown into turkey buildings if it was attached to field debris or feathers. Dr. Mick Fulton researches avian diseases at Michigan State University Diagnostic Laboratory in Lansing. He says wind has been known to spread infectious laryngotracheitis in his state. That's a viral disease that, like flu, is typically transported into barns by people or equipment.
We had a very strong wind that went in the direction of another farm that was located about 2 miles away. And then soon after that real strong wind, that farm broke with the disease.
However, Fulton doubts that wind is the primary cause of the Minnesota outbreak. He believes biosecurity failures probably account for most of the cases. Mark Cook agrees. He's a professor of animal sciences at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He says it can be extremely challenging to keep a highly infectious disease out of an animal barn if it's widespread in the environment, as this virus is thought to be. When Cook was a graduate student, his PhD project tested his ability to keep an arthritic disease called reovirus from spreading from a sick flock in one barn to his healthy chickens in a different barn. He was successful for the first 2.5 years of his 3-year project.
I don't know how it got from one barn to the other, and these were on opposite ends of the campus. But eventually I goofed, and it did get to my control, but I had enough data to get my PhD.
That experience still influences Cook's approach to poultry biosecurity. You cannot be too careful.
My wife always complains about it. Everything I ever wear gets washed every day to this day for fear that I might move something from one place to another.
Cook says he has no doubt that avian influenza can be kept out of most poultry barns, but he says it may require periods of total lockdown during the spring and fall wild bird migration seasons, and that could last for a few years, as long as these new viruses are circulating. Lorna Benson, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Republicans in the Minnesota House have released their plans for providing $2 billion in tax cuts. The biggest cuts in the House bill are $538 million for a one-time income tax exemption and $450 million to begin phasing out the statewide property tax on businesses. Here's Tim Pugmire.
House Republicans say more than 2 million Minnesotans would see money back thanks to their plan for a state version of the personal or dependent exemption. Republican House Majority Leader Joyce Pepin of Rogers said the new exemption would save a middle-class family of four more than $500 over the next 2 years.
Our priority for this tax package is very clear. It's middle-class families of Minnesota.
There are also new tax breaks in the House plan for Social Security income, military retirement pay, college loans, and farm property. It establishes a new tax-exempt savings plan for long-term care and raises the threshold for estate taxes. It also phases out the property tax on cabins. There's an $85 million cut in local government aid to three cities, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth. Republican Representative Greg Davids of Preston, chair of the House Tax Committee, said 75% of the tax relief in the bill is targeted to the middle class and actual Minnesotans. He described the bill as a response to the tax increases Democrats enacted in 2013.
I would just say that after 2 years of massive tax increases, some Minnesotans I've talked to have simply given up hope. They say we can't take an increased tax burden. But with the 2015 House Republican tax bill, I'm here to tell those taxpayers, don't stop believing.
David said it would have been pointless to propose rolling back the income tax increase on top earners that was DFL Governor Mark Dayton's priority in 2013. He said he wants his bill signed. The House Republican bill includes a $35 million expansion of the child care tax credit, but that's far less than the $100 million that the governor has proposed. David said Dayton's plan is too expensive.
Someone making $124,000 of income a household, do they need a child care credit? Kind of hard to justify that one. So I think the governor is, I like the idea the governor had, but I think he used a little bit high on his numbers.
A spokesman for the governor said he was waiting for a Department of Revenue analysis of the House bill. House Democrats didn't wait to criticize the tax proposal. DFL House Minority Leader Paul Thiessen of Minneapolis said the one-time exemption would provide minimal relief to lower-income families. Thiessen also said the Republican push for $2 billion in tax cuts is hurting other parts of the budget, including education and health care. He pointed out that the revenue loss from the business property taxes and other tax cuts will grow every year.
The massive tax giveaway is what's going to shortchange our kids and Minnesota's future. And this bill guarantees that Minnesotans will be back facing budget deficits and painful budget cuts in the near future. If everything that's in this bill were phased in this year, you would see a $2 billion budget deficit showing up this year. That's the scale of the budget deficits we're going to be facing if this bill is passed.
The House Tax Committee is expected to vote on the bill Wednesday. The full House could vote next week. Senate Democrats are preparing a $460 million tax bill that focuses on property tax cuts and tax breaks aimed at getting jobs for unemployed veterans. DFL Senator Rod Scoy of Clearbrook, chair of the Senate Tax Committee, said the long-term cost of the House bill is problematic.
We're not going to do the same actions that were done under the Ventura administration, where they had unsustainable tax cuts that caused us really to go into a deficit for a number of years. We're going to be very careful with regard to the out-years costs of these bills.
DFL Senate leaders plan to vote on all their budget bills, including the tax bill, by the end of the month. Tim Pugmire, Minnesota Public Radio News at the Capitol.
One of the fastest-growing police departments in Minnesota says it needs a bigger home. The Metro Transit Police Force has doubled in size in the last 3 years, and now it's planning a new $16 million headquarters building. Curtis Gilbert reports.
242, one by number.
Officer Jason Milan just caught a man sipping a beer out of a brown paper bag at a bus stop.
You can't be drinking out here. Do you have any ID?
He decides to let the guy go with a warning. But they do have to pour out his booze.
You think you're one less well?
You got to drink more, right?
I'm just kidding, man.
Milan says this is a pretty typical day in the life of a transit cop. Mostly, officers focus on the type of low-level crime that can make riding the bus uncomfortable for other passengers.
Panhandling, you know, sometimes people are loitering, might be some narcotics, people selling drugs, using drugs. Fights, quite often, stuff that makes it harder for people who are out here working and using the transit to get home and stuff. We want to make it pleasant for them.
Metro Transit has significantly stepped up this kind of policing. The more robust downtown beats came as part of an overhaul championed by Chief John Harrington.
When I got here, we had a couple of offices that worked in downtown St. Paul and a couple of offices that worked in downtown Minneapolis and a couple out of the Mall of America. What we recognized was that a couple of officers only gave us a very thin police presence in some really important corners of our cities.
Between the beefed up beat patrols and the opening of the new light rail Green Line between St. Paul and Minneapolis, Harrington has been on a hiring spree. When he joined the department in 2012, it had 100 full and part-time officers. Today, it has more than 200. The chief says the bigger force is more effective, but it's also straining the capacity of the department's current headquarters on Minnehaha Avenue in Minneapolis. On a tour of the facility, Harrington stops and motions toward a dim corner of the garage.
That's our gym, to the extent that we have one.
Wait, what's our gym? I don't even see it.
Well, that medicine ball, the two weights, and the straps, that's as much of a gym as we can accommodate in this building.
The garage is one of many spaces doing double duty. Investigators who need to interrogate a suspect sometimes have to wait for a meeting to clear out so they can use the only conference room. Roll call is held in the lunchroom, which also houses some of the terminals where officers write their police reports. And Harrington says the women's locker room is stuffed into what used to be a closet.
At this point, if I have any women that come on, I almost have to send them to East Command because I don't have enough locker room space for any more women in this building.
The new headquarters building will be almost twice the size of the current one. It's scheduled to open in 2017 near some existing Metro Transit buildings just north of Target Field. Annette Meeks says that building deserves more scrutiny. Meeks oversaw Metro Transit for 8 years when she served on the Metropolitan Council under Republican Governor Tim Pawlenty. She likens the department's recent growth to the invasive plant kudzu, which infested her lawn when she lived in the South.
And kudzu kind of creeps into your yard, and the next thing you know, your garden is overrun with kudzu, and you can't get rid of it. That's a little bit like some of these agencies in state government. You turn your back for a little bit, and suddenly you're overwrought with a giant state agency that you didn't see and you didn't know was even there.
Meeks notes there are relatively few serious crimes reported on the transit system, 500 to 600 in recent years, compared to the 23,000 handled by the Minneapolis Police Department. And she questions whether Metro Transit needs such a large, independent police force.
In Minneapolis, we have Park Police, we have Metro Transit Police, and we have, of course, the Minneapolis Police, not to discount the Hennepin County Sheriff's Department. And you have to start to wonder, how many police vehicles do we need? How many different police forces do we need? And maybe at some point in time, it would be wise to talk about consolidation.
Metro Transit plans to add close to 100 more officers over the next 5 years. State data show it's already the seventh largest police force in the state. Curtis Gilbert, Minnesota Public Radio News.
The Metropolitan Airports Commission has committed to voting on a higher minimum wage for some workers at the airport. Governor Mark Dayton promised he would seek a $10 minimum wage last month, and the commission is now poised to take action, despite the caution by critics of the unintended consequences. Tim Nelson talked to Steve and John about that last night.
Tim, Minnesota had a long minimum wage discussion last year. That's going to raise the current $8 an hour minimum to a $9 an hour in August. What's the difference at the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport?
Well, there are a couple things going on out here, Stephen. There's a push by low-wage workers and union organizers at the airport for a $15 minimum wage. Supporters say that airlines have been outsourcing work and pushing down wages, and airport workers need some kind of protection from changes in the business. There's also kind of an important precedent here for the region. The Airports Commission thinks about 1% of the Twin Cities area workforce works here at the airport. This could have ripple effects throughout the metro area. And finally, advocates for a higher minimum wage say that the airport is an important employment center, particularly for East African immigrants who suffer from high rates of poverty. They say this could help alleviate that poverty in the long term.
What about the employers? What are they saying?
Well, they were out here. They were also speaking to the matter in front of the Airports Commission today. They included the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. They voiced some concern that added costs like this could force some of the air services that business needs, that they could force that away from Minnesota and MSP. There was also a spokesman for Airlines for America. That's the trade group that represents the 7 passenger and 3 cargo carriers at the airport here. Rob DeLucia questioned the legal basis for treating one industry, air transport, different than other businesses in Minnesota. He also questioned whether the MAC, the Airport Commission, had the legal authority to set wages. And he also said this is going to be very difficult to implement because of the complex nature of the airport workforce. There's so many different employers and employment situations, from taxi drivers to people who might work at the airport for a company that's not at the airport.
Now, if they do raise the minimum wage, who would this benefit?
That's one of the big questions they have to answer. There's more than 17,000 people that work at the airport, from highly paid airline employees to kind of seasonal snow shovelers. The average wage for that whole group is actually pretty high, more than $30 an hour, according to an internal airport report. But there are about 2,800 contract employees. Now, these are people who clean planes and push wheelchairs and drive carts. They make a lot less, sometimes minimum wage, like that $8. And that's principally who this would affect. But, you know, this could also apply to others, like wait staff at airport restaurants. That's one of the things that the commission has to decide here. And, you know, it could be you and me, too. Anybody who flies here right now pays just under $7 per passenger in airport fees. Now, if they have to pay more to the workers, the airlines could pass that along to their customers, and you or I could be paying more for our ticket or our pre-flight meal here at the airport.
So it's not just the people who are getting a raise, it's the people who would be paying for it. What's next in the process?
Well, the MAC isn't really clear actually how to implement this yet. One option would be to simply pass an ordinance and have it apply to everyone at the airport. They could also negotiate this with contracts and vendors. MAC Chairman Dan Bovin said he might even like a $15 an hour minimum wage. They also may just decide to add a dollar on top of the state minimum wage.
When will we know more?
Well, this 15-member commission is going to have a special meeting to discuss this on May 18th. They expect airport managers to have a range of options to go forward. May take some time to implement, but we should see what direction they'd like to go by the middle of next month.
All right. Thanks for the update.
You're welcome.
Tim Nelson reporting from Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport.
Minnesota manufacturers are turning to robots to help ease a labor shortage. Robots are not new in large manufacturing plants, but small companies across Minnesota are embracing a new generation of robots to stay competitive. Here's Dan Gunderson.
The big now hiring sign outside Cosmos Enterprises is pretty much a permanent fixture.
Always looking for skilled people.
Hard to find?
And almost impossible. That's why we got a robot.
Robert Grove runs the small machine shop in the western Minnesota town of Elbow Lake, population just shy of 1,200. He has 23 employees who build parts for other manufacturing companies. He trains most of the workers he hires because it's hard to find skilled workers who will move to a small town.
Not only is there a lack of skilled workers, but there's just a lack of workers. So what we're finding is we got to start adapting and figure out what to do.
So a few months ago, he invested nearly $250,000 in a robot. In the brightly lit shop, the robot sits in a cage to keep workers from walking into the rapidly moving arm. The robot's job is to load metal blocks into computerized machine tools that shape the parts. Then the robot removes the finished part. Grove says the robot never eats lunch or takes a bathroom break.
For sure you gain 45 minutes a day of production. That's real money.
Grove says the robot doubled the output of 2 milling machines, and his skilled workers can now focus on using their skills, not simply loading parts into a machine all day. Grove says there's a steep learning curve, but he's convinced his company won't survive without embracing automation.
It's going to get worse as far as I'm concerned, just with the baby boomers retiring. I mean, there's a ton of skilled people retiring every day.
Grove is already thinking about adding a second robot. A half hour east, Alexandria Industries has more than a decade of experience with robots. This is a much bigger business, employing about 370 workers. They make aluminum parts for everything from medical equipment to military rifles.
We have 9 robots tending machines today. I've got 2 more robots on order right now, and scheduled to order 2 more before the end of the year.
Engineer Todd Carlson says robots have a checkered history at the company. The first, Rosie, was purchased in 2001 to make parts for the telecommunications industry. Then the dot-com bubble burst, the contract disappeared, and the nearly $500,000 investment sat unused.
You know, for 4 or 5 years, we were pretty disappointed with robotics.
But robots have changed. They're easier to program and more adaptable to different jobs. Carlson says workers haven't been replaced by the robots. No one lost their job. But the company has been able to expand despite a perpetual labor shortage.
Tough labor market out there, and automation is really helping us through that.
And Carlson says having robots do repetitious tasks makes for happier workers.
They don't like loading parts. They like troubleshooting. They like problem solving. So it really changes the level of operator that we're able to attract and really gives them more satisfaction in the job that they're doing.
Many Minnesota manufacturing companies have a hard time finding workers. A survey last year found 67% of companies reported difficulty in filling open positions. Bob Kill's business consulting firm Enterprise Minnesota also reports that about 45% of manufacturing in Minnesota happens outside the metro area. He says many of those companies have no choice but to focus on efficiency. Mark Sagadol helps companies automate. He teaches robotics at Alexandria Technical and Community College and advises companies on training workers to use robots.
10 years ago, 15 years ago, the big trend was outsource because we could do it cheaper, faster, overseas somewhere else because of the labor cost. And the big thing was the labor cost. The problem, the issue that manufacturing saw was that the quality isn't there.
So some of that work is coming back to U.S. companies. And Sagadol says the expanding use of robots might just convince more young workers to consider manufacturing jobs. Dan Gunderson, Minnesota Public Radio News, Alexandria.
Minneapolis-based Target's blockbuster sale of Lilly Pulitzer apparel and accessories Sunday infuriated some customers. Products quickly sold out, and online shoppers briefly overwhelmed the retailer's website. But analysts say the event confirms that even after several years of struggles, Target can still create excitement and buzz with its cheap chic strategy. Martin Moylan has more.
Hundreds of customers lined up outside some Target stores Sunday morning, waiting to race in when the doors opened. They loaded up on dresses, bags, napkins, towels, shoes, and anything else bearing the Lilly Pulitzer brand, known for its bright, colorful floral prints. It wasn't the same merchandise you'll find in boutiques. The goods were created and produced by Target in collaboration with Lilly Pulitzer designers and sold only at Target. But prices were half or less what shoppers typically pay for similar Pulitzer products. It was Target's latest attempt to bring fashion to the masses, and the masses responded overwhelmingly.
It's a real positive in terms of creating tons of buzz.
Carol Speakerman is a retail consultant.
This is really good timing for Target to have a successful designer collection launch. It's really showing that Target still got its mojo, and its mojo in the fashion arena particularly.
Lilly Pulitzer founded her namesake line in Florida in 1959, introducing a new fashion genre, American resort wear, characterized by vibrant colors and patterns. She famously said, quote, "Anything is possible with sunshine and a little pink." But the nearly instantaneous disappearance of Target's inventory left many would-be buyers feeling blue. One shopper tweeted, quote, "Target needs to stop releasing designer collaboration lines if they can't handle the demand and stock appropriately." Another shopper lamented that some people are now selling Lilly for Target stuff on eBay for double or more what they paid for it. Her tweet, quote, "There's a special place in hell for you." Lots of news outlets ran stories about the dissatisfaction. But business analysts generally agreed the Pulitzer event was much more of a success than a failure for Target. Stock analyst Brian Yarbrough follows the company for Edward Jones.
The website going down was a little bit of a negative for him. What overshadows that is this really created a buzz around Target, really created a buzz that, hey, maybe Target's back. And that's the whole point here is we've got to get back to fashionable, excited merchandise that drives people to the stores.
Target's performance got a somewhat lower, albeit passing grade from retail consultant Howard Davidowitz.
I would probably give them a C+,
but the idea was a very good one, has worked for Target in the past.
Davidowitz says Target has to remain open for business online, no matter how heavy the traffic.
They have to fix it. Target's future, the growth in the business is going to be online. And they've got a hell of a long way to go in handling the traffic that comes in, because this is not the first time this has happened to Target.
Target had similar woes during a 2011 collaboration with the Italian design house Mazzoni. Target officials insist the website did not crash this time, saying they decided to stop customers from entering the website for about 15 minutes Sunday to manage the onslaught. Spokesman Joshua Thomas says Target did not expect such a strong response.
We never intend for one of these programs to sell out in just a day. We always anticipate and plan for several weeks. But again, you don't know how the consumer is going to react until you give them a chance to shop the collection.
Thomas says Target has done more than 150 collaborations with designers, but the Pulitzer event was among the most successful. He says there's not much Lilly Pulitzer merchandise still available, but customers can keep an eye out for returned items. Indy estimates that less than 2% of the Lilly Pulitzer merchandise Target sold is being resold online. In the outcome left investors in a buying mode. The company's share price rose more than 1% to nearly $81. Martin Moylan, Minnesota Public Radio News.
The Minnesota Wild have a 2-1 lead in a playoff series against the St. Louis Blues. The Wild beat the Blues 3-0 last night in front of a raucous hometown crowd in St. Paul. Peter Cox was there.
Wild goalie Devan Dubnyk played his first ever home playoff game at the XL Energy Center last night after the Wild scored the game's first goal in the second period. Dubnyk says his ears were ringing.
Yeah, it was like playing deaf. You couldn't hear the whistle. You couldn't hear sticks or pucks or bodies or anything. He's pushing around and trying to stay focused. So it was a lot of fun. I thought we used it to our advantage.
Dubnyk stopped 17 shots on goal and shut out Blues scorers. The sellout crowd also used their voices to goad Blues goalie Jake Allen. St. Louis is a perennial playoff contender, but has bowed out in the first round in the last 2 years. The Wild got as far as the conference semifinals last season. Minnesota native and Wild star Zach Parise says fans have high expectations this year.
Hockey in particular, I think it's just part of the culture here, and I think that, you know, they're loyal and they're excited about us being in the postseason, and you want to give them a good performance, you want to put on a good show for them.
It's been an up-and-down year for the Minnesota Wild. They began the season with some national hockey writers predicting the team could make the Western Conference Finals. But after a hot start, the Wild's luck took strange and sad turns. The team's two star players, Parise and defenseman Ryan Suter, both dealt with the deaths of their fathers, and 5 Wild players missed games due to the mumps. But then the Wild went on a dominating run, working back into the playoff hunt with one of the NHL's best second half records. Most Wild fans will tell you one player was key.
Dubnyk, he made a big difference.
Sherry Swanson of Plymouth, a partial season ticket holder, said the Wild's trade in January changed the season.
The whole team in general has been good, but he's made it. That's why we're here.
The 28-year-old Dubnyk has gone 27-9-2 since joining the Wild, and some have made arguments for his winning the National Hockey League's MVP award. But coach Mike Yeo says the Wild also brings more depth than they've had in years, including several players with valuable playoff experience.
The team atmosphere is very good right now. Everybody's all in for each other, and obviously we're hoping to make this a very long run here, which means that everybody will factor in.
When the Wild make the playoffs, it's exceptional for us.
Across from the XL Energy Center, Eagle Street Grill co-owner Joe Castle says playoff hockey fills his bar, even during away games.
Generally speaking, the fans come out real hot and heavy during the playoffs, and there's a lot more of them, and we tend to get a lot of people that can't get tickets to get into the game will come down and watch the games in the bars and restaurants in the area.
The Wild play the Blues tomorrow night at 8:30 and then go back to St. Louis for Game 5. Peter Cox, Minnesota Public Radio News.
That's the Minnesota News for Tuesday. I'm Phil Picardi. I'll have the NPR News Update again on Wednesday.